to Sesshin, a new way of life for a few days. The vow that we just chanted is Dogen Zenji's vow, which is traditionally recited before a Dharma talk, in Sesshin in particular. So, especially since we're studying Dogen the Sesshin, let's recite his vow in the mornings before the talk. So this Sesshin is something a little bit different. It's the first time we're here doing what's called a Genzo-e Sesshin. Genzo-e is a type of Sesshin. So Sesshin, as you probably know, means to gather the mind, collect the mind. Sesshin. Gather the mind, collect the mind, touch the mind or the heart. Shin means heart or mind. And generally involves zazen, sitting meditation, and plenty of it to collect the mind together in here and now. And usually in Zen, Sesshin is almost all silent, and there may be a talk once a day for encouragement. But then there's this other form of mind gathering called Genzo-e Sesshin, also involving Zazen as the basic ground practice, and at the same time deeply investigating an essay, a fascicle, a chapter of Dogen's Shobo Genzo. Shobo Genzo means true, authentic Dharma. Sho and ho, but you put them together, it sounds like Shobo. True Dharma. I, Gen is I, and Zo is like treasury or storehouse. So it's the true Dharma I storehouse, the authentic truth or Dharma. I, like that, you know, I that sees treasury or storehouse, Shobo Genzo. So it can be abbreviated for, when we say Genzo-e Sesshin, it's the I storehouse Sesshin. The I storehouse mind gathering. We're in an I storehouse mind gathering. Welcome. Beautiful, I think, these words evoke. The treasury of the I, or the treasury of eyes. And this tradition of Genzo-e Sesshin, I don't know how old it is, but I think it maybe goes back some centuries. Probably originated at Eheiji, which is Dogen's monastery that he founded in Japan. And it's a time to deeply investigate, which is a word that Dogen himself uses frequently. Thoroughly investigate these teachings that he brings up. And I feel already it's so encouraging and so beautiful to come together like this and study these teachings, but not just in a normal class format, but in this special container of Sesshin, where we have, you know, chanting and orioki meals and zazen and kinhin and all that goes on through the day of Sesshin. So I hope that this will be a time where these teachings that come more alive in our day-to-day practice, interspersing maybe a lot of talking, and I hope to open it up for discussion, but a lot of silent sitting also, and silence during the breaks and so on. I think that combination is rare and a great opportunity. And Genzo A Sesshins in this country, I've heard about them through Shohaku Okamura Roshi, who has been leading Genzo A Sesshins for some years as a wonderful Dogen scholar that he is. And I think people find them encouraging. And there's also a Sesshin that we'll do this fall called Denko A Sesshin. So A actually means assembly. You might have heard this word Zazen Kai, which means like in Japan, like kind of like maybe we would do on a Wednesday night is sort of like a Zazen Kai, or a one day sitting. It means like a Zazen assembly at a small temple. And this word Kai can also be read as A, just two different sounds for the same character. And it means like a gathering or assembly. So we're having an eye treasury gathering, or eye treasury assembly, to study the Shobo Genzo. And in the fall, we're having Denko A, based on Denko as an abbreviation for Denko Roku, which is the other great Soto Zen text. So Soto Zen, our school of Zen, is based on the teachings of, we almost say, sometimes say, two founders, Eihei Dogen Zenji and Keizan Jokin Zenji. And in America, we tend not to emphasize Keizan and his teachings so much. We really, Dogen did actually write a lot more, and his writings are truly awesome and have many different styles and aspects. So I think Dogen is studied more widely than Keizan, but Keizan was just a couple of generations after Dogen in Japan, and his main work is called the Denko Roku, or Transmission of Light. So there's also a tradition in Japan, and probably, I would guess, also originating at Sojiji, which is Keizan's founded temple, called Denko A Sesshin. And this is an assembly to study the transmission of light and the record of transmission of light, which is the story, the awakening stories of all the ancestors of our lineage. And so I'm also looking forward to this fall going into some of those stories. Very nice, because they're all set up as biographical stories with some details of the ancestors' lives, but based around a particular dialogue in which their mind was opened to Dharma. But today we'll start with this Genzo-e Sesshin on this particular Shobo Genzo fascicle. Fascicle means like a section of a larger work that could be read on its own, or that could stand alone. So it's kind of a funny word that we hardly ever use, and we could just, I often just say essay. It's an essay by Dogen. But if we say a chapter of the Shobo Genzo, then it sounds like, well, you should read the chapters in order of a book, right? But a fascicle could be read as part of a larger work or stand alone. And we have various versions of the Shobo Genzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye of Dogen. And the most maybe popular, or these days, or I think most interesting actually to read, it's the most all-inclusive, is this 95 fascicle, Shobo Genzo. And you can tell from the fact that it's 95 fascicles that Dogen was trying to make a round number of 100, but he just died too early. And he has some other short essays that could be added in here, but I think the compilers felt like there's a certain style and presentation in the Shobo Genzo. It does make a cohesive whole, and some of the other essays don't quite fit in the same style, so they're not included. And there's shorter versions that are just the order is different, the order of the fascicles. But the 95 fascicle version, I really appreciate because it's in chronological order. So you really have a sense, if you kind of go through it in order, of how Dogen's thought developed over time and how he really did. His emphasis changed, it seems like, and style changed a little bit, although it's also a cohesive whole. And it includes almost all the essays intended for Shobo Genzo. So it begins with, the 95 fascicle version begins with Bendowa, the talk on the wholehearted way that we studied this last fall, that Dogen wrote in 1231, shortly after he returned from China, where he had met his teacher and awakened to the way, and he was trying to find a way to bring out these his new understanding in Japan, where he felt like people understood Buddhism differently, and Zen was just beginning, and the people understood Zen a little bit differently too. So he wrote that essay when he was just kind of practicing alone, it seems like. He kind of talks that way in Bendowa. And then around that time, he found this kind of sub-temple in the back of another temple in Kyoto, and fixed it up and started practicing with a few other people there. And that's called Koshoji or Kosho Horinji. It's since moved. In Japan, there's still a Koshoji because it's the temple that Dogen founded, but they moved the location. This was before Eiheiji, his main monastery where the practice really took off. So at the time of living at Koshoji and practicing with just a few students, Dogen wrote the Genjo Koan, maybe his most famous, well-known Shobo Genzo fascicle, beautiful writing that we'll actually study this fall. And he didn't do so much writing. I think he was probably very busy trying to figure out where to practice and how to how that was going to work in this new place. And but he did write a little bit more. This was like so Genzo Koan was written a couple years after Bendowa, and then he wrote One Bright Pearl, Ika Myoju, a couple years later. I think he was just kind of experimenting with writing in these early years. And these were written essays too, which is not that unusual. What's most unusual about it is that he wrote in colloquial Japanese. Most people who are writing Zen texts and Zazen manuals and things like that wrote in classical Chinese, which is sort of like our Latin, just because it's the formal way of writing a classical text. But Dogen, just like the Buddha, wrote in the, you know, easy to read language of the day. The Buddha also said, let's not use special languages. I guess Sanskrit probably existed at the time of Buddha, but he just spoke in local dialects. And later sutras were written in Sanskrit. Dogen wrote One Bright Pearl in maybe 1236, 35, 36. And then in 1237, he wrote this fascicle that we'll study called This Very Mind is Buddha. So it's one of the very early teachings of Dogen. And I think, I don't know how long we'll study Dogen at Santa Cruz Zen Center, but I feel like it's a nice way so far to be starting at the beginning, basically. Bendowa, Genjo Koan, and this Sokushin Zeibutsu. And just go and maybe skip some of the less really juicy fascicles, but because 95 is a lot. But go through, you know, start kind of in order like this and see how Dogen's thought develops. Also, some people say this is a really important fascicle or important topic for Dogen, and I found this article from this talk that I gave before I arrived, maybe, about the Soto Zen constitution. So Soto Shu, the school of Zen in Japan, like any organization, has a constitution. And the constitution lays out all the bylaws and everything, but it starts with just, you know, the Dharma principles. And this is like, I don't know when this was written, maybe more recently, 100 years ago or something, maybe longer. But it's kind of the mission statement for Soto Zen. And the constitution says, abiding by the true Dharma of the Buddhas and ancestors, single transmission, the Soto school doctrine is transmission of just sitting, shikantaza, and this very mind is Buddha, sokushin zebutsu. So these two principles are like the basic doctrine of the Soto school. And as it says later in here, they're really the same thing from two different angles. Just sitting is like describing the physical practice of sitting as a physical posture, and just doing it is what we do. And but what is the mind of Zazen? What is the mind of Shikantaza, of just wholeheartedly sitting? It's the mind that's open to this very mind being Buddha. So again, a very important teaching for Dogen and Zen in general, and the mind of Zazen, not necessarily just during sitting either, but the mind of Zazen, or the mind of Zen throughout the day, this very mind is Buddha. So we can hear that and think, oh yeah, okay, this very mind is Buddha. But Dogen is going to clarify all the kind of misinterpretations of what that might mean and put forth his own interpretation. It seems that he feels like there were many misinterpretations of this saying that was popular in his day, maybe. And so he spends a lot of the, maybe half of the essay, just talking about misunderstandings of this very mind as Buddha before he sets forth his own. Sokushin Zebutsu is this very mind is Buddha. So to look at the title a little bit, soku means immediately, or here and now. Nishijima Roshi translates it as mind here and now is Buddha. But immediately, here and now, this very, quickly, suddenly, this, you know, has this kind of feeling, a kind of vivid suddenness. I think immediately is a good translation, or itself. So mind itself is Buddha, or this immediate mind is Buddha, mind here and now is Buddha, is the feeling. And soku, so shin means mind, or heart, wonderful way of understanding, in not just in China and Japan where shin means mind or heart, but also in Sanskrit, the word chitta can mean like mind or heart, maybe more on the mind side, because they also have the word hridaya in Sanskrit that means heart. So when we say the Makahanyaharamita Shingyo is the Heart Sutra. It's the same Shin, the Shin Sutra, and but that's translated from the Hridaya Sutra, which literally means the heart of great perfect wisdom. And but of course, in Chinese, Dogen can really play with such things. So he's He has another early fascicle on Prajnaparamita, and he talks about the, the Heart Sutra and the Body Sutra. So it's kind of like he's always saying body and mind dropping off. So you could say, dropping off the Mind Sutra / Heart Sutra and dropping off the Body Sutra. So Xin, I think it's generally pointing it more in the mind direction, but mind and heart, how can we separate them actually? And the character Zay just means like is. And Butsu means Buddha. So this very mind is Buddha. And Soku Zay is used in the Heart Sutra when it's talking about form and emptiness. So when we say Shiki Soku Zay Ku, Ku Soku Zay Shiki. So Shiki means form or color, form, and Ku means emptiness or sky. And so Shiki Soku Zay Ku means form itself is emptiness, or form, it's again this immediately is, or form here and now is emptiness. So it's a nice way of translating, I don't know what the Sanskrit original was, but it's really emphasizing that like form doesn't kind of like eventually become emptiness or something like that, that form here and now itself immediately is emptiness. The soku really emphasizes that. So Shiki soku ze ku, ku soku ze shiki. Emptiness itself is form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself, form. So we chanted that this morning in the midst of lots of other sounds. So it's in there in the middle somewhere. And this phrase, Soku Shin Ze Butsu, mind itself is Buddha, mind immediately here and now is Buddha, did not originate with Dogen. It seems to have originated with the great Chinese ancestor Matsu. Ancestor Ma. I think Ma was his family name, so they just called him Ancestor Ma. Tzu means like ancestor. Matsu said, this very mind is Buddha. And Matsu was one of the very early Chan ancestors in China. Two generations after the sixth ancestor, Hui Nung, when the first writing, in a way, of Zen, some of the first was the Platform Sutra of the sixth ancestor, and then these teachings of Chan in China started spreading around the country. Buddhism had been in China for many centuries before, but this new movement called Chan or Zen, which was, we could say, the essence of this new movement was mind here and now is Buddha. Before Bodhidharma and those first six ancestors of Chan came to China, Buddhism was kind of a scholastic project to try to understand Buddhism, and a lot of ritual and study and meditation practice too, but the direct experience of being Buddha was more like something that might happen in the very distant future. To say that mind itself here and now is Buddha was almost like heresy, I think, when it first got presented. There were Mahayana schools and Prajnaparamita sutras that might emphasize this kind of understanding, but to say it really up front like this was something new and controversial, and many people were, you hear it in these early Zen stories in China, people were kind of against these early Zen teachers. They thought they're defiling the Buddha Dharma by saying things like this. So a Sikh ancestor had a disciple named Nan Yue, and then Matsu met Nan Yue and practiced with him. So it was two generations after the sixth ancestor. And you might know the story about Matsu and Nan Yue and polishing the tile. Do you know the tile polishing story? Who knows the tile polishing story? Well, maybe worth saying this because, at least briefly, because it's so... this is how Matsu awakened to the way, and it relates to this very mind as Buddha. So Matsu was a very diligent student and always sitting zazen at Nan Yue's monastery. And Nan Yue recognized him as a Dharma vessel. And I think he's very devoted, so he may be able to understand this teaching of Zen. And so he went up to him one time and said, what are you doing here? What are you doing sitting in meditation here and all the time? And Matsu said, I'm trying to make a Buddha, or I want to become a Buddha. So already, like, you see, he hasn't understood the teaching of mind itself, here and now, immediately, is Buddha. Or he wouldn't be able to say, I want to become a Buddha. Now later, Dogen plays with this story and says he actually did understand, and he's just playing out this dialogue, and it's a Buddha that wants to become a Buddha. But we won't get into this at this time. So I want to become a Buddha. So Nan Yue, next to him, you know, picks up a tile or something like a tile, and starts to polish it with a cloth. And Matsu looks over and says, what are you doing? Nan Yue says, I'm polishing this tile to make a mirror. And Matsu says, well, how can you make a mirror by polishing a tile? To which Nan Yue replies, how can you make a Buddha by sitting zazen? So this is this wonderful principle. As I say this, I think, this may be my favorite Zen story ever, because it just points so directly, right, to the immediacy of practice versus the gradual polishing type of practice. So then Matsu says, well, then what should I do? How do I practice then? If I can't make a Buddha by sitting zazen, then just like you can't make a mirror from polishing a tile, then what's the practice? And Nan Yue says, when a cart doesn't move, an ox cart doesn't move, do you strike the cart or strike the ox? And people say, you know, interpret this metaphor in different ways, but maybe the most straightforward way is, it's kind of like, we could say that the cart is like practice. Sometimes they say it's like body and mind. Do you strike the body? Maybe we could say it like this, that the, you know, zazen is like putting the body in a particular position, and any practice that we do with the body, and any practice we do with the body, and we could even say, or mind, but a practice that we do is like the body. Do you strike that? In other words, do you emphasize the practice that you're doing, or do you emphasize the ox, which is the one pulling the practice, like the source of the practice, the mind, but meaning like the true nature of mind. Strike means like, you know, do you emphasize, do you put your attention on, you know, trying to get the cart to like move, even though the mind is kind of stuck in front, you start pushing the cart against this like sleeping ox, or do you try to wake up the ox? But so when the cart doesn't move, do you strike the cart or strike the ox? And Matsu doesn't reply. He's contemplating this. And Nanyue goes on, are you practicing sitting meditation, sitting Zen, or are you practicing sitting Buddha? As for sitting meditation, or Zen, is neither sitting nor lying down. In other words, it's not about the posture. As for sitting Buddha, Buddha has no fixed marks. In non-abiding Dharma, there's no grasping or rejecting. If you try to sit like a Buddha, you're just killing the Buddha. If you attach to the form or mark of sitting, like the posture, you'll never realize the principle. So it's pointing to something really fundamental, basic about the mind, the Buddha mind, Buddha nature, that's free from grasping and rejecting and whatever's happening in the appearance world of practice and form. So when Matsu heard this, he felt as if he had tasted ghee. Instead of saying he greatly awakened, it was like tasting ghee, really good Indian ghee. So that's kind of like Matsu's early awakening. And then he continued to practice with his teacher. And but I think he, just after that dialogue, he understood something different about mind and Buddha and the relationship of mind and Buddha. Like it's maybe a kind of a sokuze relationship. So then Matsu later was teaching on another mountain, and he'd say things like, so Baijan, one time, Baijan is another really great Chinese ancestor who some people say founded the Zen monastic system and is famous for saying a day without work is a day without eating, because he was really into like communal labor and you know, manual labor supporting the Zen community. This was this new style in Zen. And many other things, like the fox. That's the Baijan, right? It's the fox. So he's a student of Matsu. And so when he's still a student, Baijan asks, what's the intent of the Buddhas, or what's the direction that Buddhas aim? And Matsu says, it's the very place where you let go of body and mind. Which I just think is wonderful, because it's so similar to Dogen's description of awakening as dropping off body and mind. Maybe not exactly the same characters, but virtually the same. That's the intent of all the Buddhas, being in the place where you let go of body and mind, let go of all grasping, and thus recognize this very mind as Buddha. So later, Matsu became known for this saying, mind itself is Buddha. He must have replied this way a lot, and it became like a popular slogan, and people later commented on it, including Dogen. Interestingly, Dogen in this fascicle never brings up Matsu and doesn't quote any of these stories about Matsu saying mind is Buddha. which he often does, try to, you know, pull out any stories of, based on the phrase he's investigating. So this is, since Dogen didn't bring out some of these stories about mind is Buddha from Matsu. I think he already had been teaching this for a while at this point, when Chan Master Phat Chan of Dame Mountain went to see Matsu for the first time. He asked, "What is Buddha?" So this is Dame, which means great plum. So great plum came to Ancestor Ma and said, "What is Buddha?" And Matsu said, "Sokushinze Butsu, this very mind is Buddha." And on hearing this, Great Plum had great awakening. Isn't it awesome that sometimes this happens, right? You hear this, such a simple thing, "This very mind is Buddha," but how did he hear that, that he just greatly awakened to it? And he hadn't heard that before? Or was it the end of a long dialogue? Or was it just like, "What's Buddha? This mind is Buddha." Boom! Maybe that's the kind of person Matsu was. Is just the way he said it was so direct and confident that Great Plum just awakened. Or maybe Great Plum was just really ready to hear this. He was right on the edge. Anyway, he had a great awakening, and then he went to live on Great Plum Mountain. When the ancestor Matsu heard that he was residing on the mountain, he sent one of the monks at his place to go there and ask him, "What did you obtain when you saw Matsu that you've come to live on this mountain?" So Matsu says to, you know, one of his students, "Go over to, would you please do this Dharma assignment? Go walk over to Great Plum Mountain. It's going to take you a few weeks probably to get there. And just go ask this hermit living there. He's just living alone on this mountain. What did you hear from Matsu, me, that, you know, impelled you to live on this mountain?" And so he goes and asks him, and Great Plum says, "Matsu told me that mind is Buddha, so I came to live here." Which is, I think, kind of nice that he didn't say, "He told me mind is Buddha, and I understood what that meant, and it means this, and then I like decided, what should I do now? I should live as a hermit." It's just like, "Matsu told me that mind is Buddha, so I came to live here." That was kind of maybe partly how his awakening, that he understood mind is Buddha, is things became very simple for him at this point. Maybe he just walked to the nearest mountain and said, "Mind is Buddha, and here's some leaves to eat, and here's some sky to enjoy, and I'll just sit here enjoying that mind is Buddha." And the monk said, I think probably directed by Matsu. It doesn't say that here, but I think I've heard it elsewhere, as Matsu told him to say this, that the monk said, "Well, actually, Matsu's teaching has changed recently." Have you heard this story?
No.
This is a kind of a really fun old Zen story. I'm sorry, but his teaching's changed. And Great Plum says, "Well, what's the difference? What does he say now?" And the monk says, "Now he says, not mind, not Buddha, or neither mind nor Buddha." Kind of like the opposite. And Great Plum says, "That old man still hasn't stopped confusing people. You can have not mind, not Buddha. I only care for this mind is Buddha." You can go now. And so kind of like, you know, that's fine. He teaches like that now, but this mind is Buddha. And So I think this is a really interesting story because it sounds like he's kind of like stuck on his thing, right? He seems like kind of fixed on like, I got it with mind as Buddha, so like, I know everything's impermanent, and the Dharma just keeps expanding and evolving, and now there's this great new teaching from the teacher who awakened me. Cool, let me explore, not mind, not Buddha. But he's kind of like, no, this mind is Buddha, you can go now. But then the monk returns to Matsu and reports what happened, and Matsu says, the plum is ripe. Meaning like, usually interpreted anyway as, great plum is like really, he's fully matured. So, you know, this is a koan story. Maybe it wouldn't have gotten recorded if he said like, oh, he's so stubborn. But that, I think that's what's curious about this story is that, he's praising him for just not taking on his new teaching. It was kind of a test. And, you know, you can contemplate this however you'd like, and maybe worth contemplating. But one way we might be able to see it is just he's so confident. He's like, you can hear another, I hear another teaching, but and that's nice, and I could investigate that too, but it's like you're trying to like see if I still have some doubt about my practice and my understanding, and I don't. You know, and it's going to maybe sound a little bit like I'm stubborn. Like we have another story of Fuyo Dokai, one of our ancestors. And there's a little dialogue, and he has this awakening, and he just like ends the discussion because he kind of wakes up, and he just starts leaving. He just starts walking away. And the teacher says, "Wait a minute. Do you have no more doubt?" And he covers his ears and just keeps walking in the story. And I hear that in kind of the same way. It's like, you know, don't try to question me anymore. Don't say anything else. Like, I can't. This is an irreversible understanding. Even if we say it in some other words, it's like it's as clear as day. It's like, you know, tasting water and knowing whether it's warm or cold for oneself. And then another story about this very mind is Buddha. This is another kind of classic one you might have heard too. A monk comes to Matsu and says, "Why do you say that mind is Buddha? Why do you say that?" And Matsu says, "To stop small children from crying." I think it might literally say in the Chinese something like, it's like giving children yellow paper and telling them it's gold. To stop them from crying. Give me some gold. Here's some. That might not be the same story, but I think it might be. Or a different version of it. Why do you say that mind is Buddha? To stop small children from crying. Not to, like, you know, awaken people who are right on the edge of waking up. You know, strange. Well, what do you say when they've stopped crying? The monk asks. Then I say, not mind, not Buddha. It's neither mind nor Buddha. And sometimes the story ends there, but this one goes on. Says the monk says, and when you have someone who does not belong to either of these two, the crying child or the one who stopped crying, how do you instruct him or her? And the ancestor says, I tell her that it's not a thing. And the monk asks, and how about when you suddenly meet someone who's there? And Matsu says, I teach him directly to realize the great way. But particularly interesting, I think, is the part of mind is Buddha is to stop small children from crying. And when they stop crying, when they They're crying because they're suffering, because they think that actually we are so far away from Buddha. Right? We are like so deluded, so ensnared in our karmic predicament that how could one help but just cry? And then you say, actually, this very mind, this very karmically ensnared mind is Buddha. Wow. And they stop crying. We could say, we could take this as, you know, small children stop crying. We could say, children is all sentient beings. And anyone who understands this teaching stops, you know, they at least basically, much of their suffering is removed by really taking to heart this very mind is Buddha. This very mind is Buddha. But when they stop crying, then we teach not mind, not Buddha. So we've just finished this class series on Nagarjuna and his teachings, that basically saying that in the end there's not mind or Buddha or anything. The Heart Sutra says this too. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Doesn't say no Buddha in the Heart Sutra, but could be implied. Nothing can be found in the end. So we could hear this also as a little kind of debate between one understanding of mind only, citta matra, mind only, that in the early Indian teachings, there's a mind only school where the basic teaching is that everything is mind. Everything we see is actually mind. And this Indian philosophical school greatly influenced Zen in China. And but it was sometimes interpreted as that everything is mind, and this mind that everything is like the only real thing in the whole universe. Mind substantially is. Now, there's early founders of Yogacara, which is sometimes said to be synonymous with mind only, citta matra, never did actually teach that mind is substantial. And in fact, they have clear teachings that say the contrary. Everything is mind, and yet mind can't be grasped either. But some interpreters of mind only say that, well, everything is mind, but then we're kind of holding this precious idea of the mind is like indestructible, real, essential. And this fascicle of Dogen, as we get into it, is going to get into this idea. And Dogen's going to talk about how it doesn't hold up. It's not valid. So I think this discussion is going to be very relevant to the study of this fascicle. That to stop small children from crying, we hear this mind is Buddha, but then we kind of stop crying, we're basically satisfied, but we're still subtly holding some reified mind. And so then, you know, then what do you teach them? And I teach them not mind, not Buddha, or, you know, no mind, no Buddha, emptiness, all-pervading, all-encompassing, unfindability, ungraspability of everything, not mind, not Buddha. And now they've, you know, not only just stopped crying, but there's no hindrance anywhere. Maybe we can come back to that story as we get into the fascicle more. This mind is Buddha, not mind, not Buddha. And I'll try to remember too, Dogen has a poem in his poem collection about this verse. I think the poem goes something like, I should check it, but Mind itself is Buddha, the first line. Practice is difficult. Explanation is easy. I should check because these might be reversed. But and I think you could actually play with it reverse either way, but it's something like mind is Buddha, practice is difficult, explanation is easy. Not mind, not Buddha. Practice is easy, explanation is difficult. I think that's be the way it would go. So it's playing with these two sides. Mind is Buddha. Practice is difficult. Explanation is easy. Not mind, not Buddha. Practice is easy. Explanation is difficult. One more story about mind is Buddha. Now another Matsu had many awakened disciples. In fact, he's maybe one of the things Matsu is most known for is having 160 fully awakened disciples or something like this, and a few of them went on to be well known teachers whose lineage is continued. One of them, including Baijiang, another one is Nan Chuan, who's known for killing the cat, and also being the teacher of Zhao Zhou, who was a really, really amazing Tang Dynasty Chinese Zen teachers. But Nan Chuan, when he was teaching, after he'd been a student of Matsu, a monk asked all the ancestors, have taught that mind is Buddha and ordinary mind is the way. Matsu is also, that was another phrase he was known for. These two sayings, ordinary mind is the way and this very mind is Buddha. They're very similar, in a way, two sides of a coin. And so, ever since Matsu, basically, everyone's taught that mind is Buddha and ordinary mind is the way. Now you, Nan Chuan, say that mind is not Buddha and wisdom is not the way. I have doubts about this. Will you be compassionate enough to instruct me? And the master said in a loud voice, if you're a Buddha, how can it be that you still have doubts and have to ask this old monk? I'm not a Buddha, and I have not seen the ancestors. Since it's you who's speaking that way, you can go see the ancestors by yourself. The monk asked, since that's so, what kind of teaching can you offer to help me? Nan Chuan said, quickly lift the empty space with your palm. The monk said, empty space has no movable form. How can I lift it? Nan Chuan said, when you say that it's without movable form, that's already a movement. How could empty space say, I have no movable form? These are all just your deluded views. The monk asked, since to say that space is without movable form is just a deluded view, then what did you ask me to lift? And Nan Chuan said, since you already know that one cannot speak about lifting it, how are you going to help it? And the monk asked, since mind is Buddha is not correct, is it that mind becomes Buddha? Since mind is Buddha, this very mind is Buddha is not correct, is it that mind becomes Buddha? And Nan Chuan said, mind is Buddha and mind becomes Buddha are just ideas created by your thinking. Do not conceive of mind and do not conceive of Buddha. Whatever you conceive of, it becomes an object. This is the so-called delusion of knowing. It's because of this that Matsu said, not mind, not Buddha, not a thing. He wanted to teach you, later generations, how to act. Nowadays, students put on their robes and walk around doubting things that are of no concern to themselves. Have you ever attained anything that way? And the monk asked, since it's not mind, not Buddha, not a thing, since that's not correct, what do you mean when you say mind is not Buddha, wisdom is not the way? And Nanjuan says, don't consider that mind is not Buddha and wisdom is not the way. I have no mind to bring up. What are you going to attach to? And the monk asked, if there's nothing at all, then in which way is it different from empty space? And Nanjuan said, since it's not a thing, how can you compare it to empty space? Also, who spoke of sameness and difference? The monk said, it cannot be that now it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not a thing, it's not right. It can't be that that saying, not mind, not Buddha, not a thing, is not right. It must be right. And the master Nanjuan said, if you understand it that way, it just becomes mind is Buddha again. So this is a long, difficult dialogue, but maybe that very end is kind of like a punchline. And they're kind of playing back and forth with this. And this is the kind of conclusion that I think is being pointed out throughout, is that the monk said, not mind, not Buddha, not a thing. This must be right. And Nanjuan says, if you understand it that way, you're just making it back into mind as Buddha. In other words, you're reifying it again. You're saying, not mind, not Buddha, everything is empty, ungraspable. That must be right. But then if you posit it like this, that just becomes this mind is Buddha in some graspable way. I'm kind of thinking, in the terms of Nagarjuna that we've been talking about, is very related. Just that Nagarjuna is basically keeps negating and negating anything we can grasp onto, but he doesn't posit anything. So it kind of leaves you with nothing, but that nothing is not a... not mind, not Buddha, not a thing, is not like just being dead or something. It's totally alive, just in the midst of this incredibly arising, vivid world, but like a small child, not able to grasp it as any particular thing. Very flexible, open mind. So that's some background on this very mind is Buddha. And he's, I think, very very direct, fresh teachings of the ancestor Matsu. And this is the golden age of Chan when these teachings came out. Now we hear them more and more because Dogen's always bringing up these stories, but people talking that way for the first time was probably very unusual and startling to people. So now, in the fascicle, Shobo Genzo Sokushinze Butsu, this mind, the mind itself is Buddha. And this translation that we're using, unpublished version by Kaz Tanahashi and Steve Allen from Zen Center, which hopefully will come out in print within this year, although it's been years in the waiting. The whole Shobo Genzo, translated by Kaz. And we have another translation by Nishijima that we can refer to. So it begins, Dogen begins, what Buddhas and ancestors have maintained without exception is mind itself is Buddha. Many Shobo Genzo fascicles begin in this kind of way. You know, he'll take the title phrase that's the subject of the essay and say that it's the one thing that all the Buddhas and ancestors have always maintained. You know, over and over again in all these different phrases. And which is nice, because it's saying this is the most important thing. Apparently Suzuki Roshi used to say also, the most important thing is such and such, and he would give some teaching. And then the next week he'd say, the most important thing in practice is this. So, you know, at the time that we're bringing it up, it's the most important thing. And it's the main thing that all Buddhas and ancestors have maintained without exception. And this translation says, however, this particular expression was not known in India. It was first heard in China by Matsu teaching it. The Nishijima translation kind of makes it sound a little bit like the opposite. Like, it's not totally clear, but kind of making it sound like this didn't just begin in China, it goes back to India, which would usually be the way that Buddha, that Dogen would be emphasizing. Dogen's always trying to make the connection that this is, any true Dharma is all-pervading, going includes Buddha's teachings in India, China, and so on. This translation says, many students, however, misunderstand that mind here and now as Buddha did not exist in India, but was first heard in China. So it's not so clear. Did they misunderstand that it was first heard in China, or did they misunderstand that it didn't exist in India? So with Dogen, you know, we could take it either way. You know, literally, we could say, scholastically, this phrase was first heard in China. It didn't appear in the sutras in India. But the understanding that mind itself is Buddha certainly was known in India. Particularly, we could say through the mind-only school. And Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature teachings, so maybe we get into later also, like teachings of Buddha nature, that everyone is fully endowed with Buddha nature, means this mind is Buddha nature from the beginning. These teachings appeared in India as well as China, and greatly influenced Zen in China and Japan. So to go on, many students misunderstand this teaching as they do not file a file about it, in parentheses, do not examine it thoroughly. And probably just translating this literally means file a file about it, and somebody liked that phrase as a kind of strange idea, so they left it in there. They do not file a file about it. They do not examine it thoroughly. File a file seems a little bit funny, like you kind of understand the thing and you put it in a file and you just put it in the drawer in a file and forget about it. But we could say files are also have a kind of interactive purpose, depending on what kind of filing thing it is. Like you're in some company, you might have files that are used by many people. So it's not just your own file cabinet, but you file a file in a particular place so that others can find it there too and benefit from it and use it when they need to. So you could say if people haven't clarified this teaching, they haven't, you know, put this file in this, in the right place where it can be accessed to benefit people in their own minds, maybe. You know, they haven't filed it in their own minds where it can then be later withdrawn to benefit others. Because they do not examine it thoroughly or do not file a file, they fall into a group of those outside the way. This is the phrase from early Buddha's teachings that outside the way means like outside the understanding of Buddha, the Buddha way. Upon hearing the phrase, mind itself is Buddha, ignorant people think that the thoughts and awareness of ordinary beings who have not yet aroused the enlightenment-seeking mind are already Buddhas. They think in this way because they've not yet met an authentic teacher. So people hear the phrase, mind itself is Buddha, and they think that thoughts and awareness of ordinary beings, or sentient beings, who have not yet aroused bodhicitta, is enlightenment-seeking mind. Hotsu bodhaishin is arousing the bodhi mind, bodhicitta. And thoughts and awareness of ordinary beings. This translation says, they interpret that ordinary beings' intellect and sense perception, which have never established the bodhi mind, are just Buddha. And the characters, the Chinese for the this intellect and sense perception, or thoughts and awareness, is it's ryo chi nen kaku. So ryo is like discriminating, deliberating mind, or discriminating, deliberating. You know, it could even be translated as like worrying, concerned. But I think in this case it means more like deliberating or discriminating. But just that, you know, something's a little bit off, right? And then qi can mean wisdom, but or knowledge in a awakened sense. But if you put this discriminating before, it's like discriminating knowledge. And we could say like, or analyzing knowledge, or, you know, mere conceptual dualistic thinking is what it seems to be implying. And then nen is like, you know, mindfulness or mind or awareness, and kaku is like usually for awakening. So it's funny characters. It's not that we're chosen by Dogen here, that he didn't just say, you know, it's the totally deluded, completely defiled, crunched up mind that doesn't, you know, he's kind of using words that could be used in this positive sense too. But I think it's this clarifying character of discriminating, or, you know, dualistic figuring kind of mind. The thoughts and awareness, discriminating thoughts and awareness of sentient beings who, but even, you know, an awareness or awakening, if we could stretch it to even to make this teaching a little bit more subtle, we could say it even the you know, awareness or mindfulness and awakeness, is what those characters literally are usually translated as, but of sentient beings who've not yet aroused bodhicitta, that kind of mind is already Buddha. So it seems to be there's some emphasis here on the enlightenment-seeking mind. Dogen seems to be criticizing that, you know, thinking that ordinary discriminating mind without this intention of awakening is not actually Buddha. So, and then he's going to get into this more as the essay goes on. But just to mention a little bit about the enlightenment-seeking mind is, recently I've been thinking of it as the wish to be free from suffering for the benefit of all beings. Really actually wanting to be free, not wanting to get something called enlightenment or awakening, not wanting to attain some special state that would be really cool, not like that. That's just gaining idea, but actually deep wish to actually be free from the grasping that binds us. The latest newsletter has a, you know, it's all about the article, and there's all about aspiration for the way, which is another way of talking about bodhicitta. But even to say aspiration for the way, way-seeking mind, enlightenment mind, can easily turn into a something to grasp, get a hold of. But to say, I, you know, really just want to be free from the delusions and greed, hate, and delusion, and the grasping that keeps me from being totally open, available, and beneficial to all beings in the most thorough way. So to be free is more like, it's not at all gaining something, it's more like losing something. Free from these things, I want to actually lose some things here. And that's one way of talking about this awakening, seeking mind. So that's enough for this first round, I think. And if there's anything you'd like to bring up about, I mean, a lot has been said about the title and the history and Matsu's teachings and this mind is Buddha. And as Dogen starts to get into this, this emphasis on bodhicitta, mind seeking the way. Yes.
The phrase "the delusion of knowing" was mentioned. Is that a quotation, or is that part of what you were saying in passing about a certain kind of mind?
Did I just say the delusion of knowing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't even notice. We could, you know, now I would say, I don't remember the context or what I said it in, but now I would say, you know, well, I think it might mean here more like deluded or discriminating knowing, dualistic knowing, but the delusion of knowing is an interesting phrase because actually that would be, I think that would be included here in the... in this teaching of Dogen's, really talking about Buddha mind and its the full implications of Buddha mind, in the you know, to bring up another classical Indian teaching about these two kinds of hindrances to full Buddhahood, and one's called the hindrance of afflictions, afflictive mind. Klesha avarana, hindrance I think is a good word. It's like literally avarana means like covering, a dark cover is like, you know, put over Buddha mind by the klesha, which is basically, you could say, greed, hate, and a lot of delusion. Kleshas are like all the, you know, say, we say afflictive emotions or negative emotions, you know, anger, jealousy, pride, all of these ways we act, particularly in relation to other beings, from, you know, or based on the delusion, particularly of an independent self. And so it's a long, long process. This is more like in the original Indian teachings before Zen. There's this removing of this covering or hindrance of the kleshas in order to reveal the Buddha mind. Even if we talk about in the Mahayana that there is this all-pervading Buddha nature, it's covered, we could say, by these hindrances. And then, and that's maybe most of the work of practices. We could, maybe in the more non-dual way, we could say seeing through these hindrances of the klesha afflictions. And then the other hindrance is called Nyeya Avarana, and it means, Nyeya means like knowledge or knowing. And there's some debate, it seems like, about what exactly this means, this Sanskrit word. Some people interpret it as the hindrances to full knowing, full like non-dual awakened knowing. But some people interpret it as the hindrance of knowing, which came to mind when you said delusion of knowing.
Yes.
You said, or deluded knowing, delusion of knowing.
The phrase that you
Yeah, delusion of knowing. I think delusion of knowing might be, we could maybe use that as a translation of jnaya avarana. It's more like the hindrance of knowing. And if we interpret it that way, it's like actually that knowing anything in a dualistic sense is actually a hindrance to full Buddha mind. And they say this one is much, much more subtle than kleshas or, you know, the afflicted emotions of greed and hate. Those are, of course, very difficult to work with, but it's usually taught in that order, that first you eliminate or see through or understand the true nature of, you know, afflicted, defiled mind states like anger and greed and so on. And then, but then there's still, you're left with this subtle dualistic knowing. And it might even, in the stories we've been bringing up, this could be saying, this very mind is Buddha, and this is it. And like, mind, this mind is like, I see it. This is the mind. I'm knowing it. Like, there's me knowing the mind. And so there's a split there. There's a dualistic split between the knower and the known mind, which doesn't really make that much sense, but yet we do that on more and more subtle levels. So the covering or hindrance of knowing, when that's lifted up or removed, Buddha mind is revealed without knowing. So in Zen we have phrases like, not knowing is most intimate, and only don't know. And so at the very deepest level in the classical teachings of realization, coursing through awakened awareness would be like not being able to even know anything dualistically, which is another way of saying everything is empty and ungraspable, including that very idea and anything we can say about it in language.
Which is when taken unsubtly, perhaps what causes certain kinds of critiques of these ways of thinking that call it obscurantist.
Obscurantist?
Yes, or meaning that the not, that kind of intimate not knowing is kind of giving up on knowing, rather than suggesting a different way of being related to knowing.
Yeah, giving up on knowing, and then, but we might speculate of like, well, if you really gave up on knowing, then how could we even function in the world? We have to know, it seems like, in order to like get up and walk out of the room and so on. So these are points to contemplate. What's the relationship to the conventional world for a not knowing one? Maybe just that, like, really not believing in, reifying the way things are appearing to happen. So we don't really know that we're walking out of the room, and we don't know that the floor will support our next step, but still we can take, we can appear to take another step. And I think any, after each of these talks, maybe there's some piece of it that can become a meditation encouragement or meditation theme for the zazen in between. any of these stories of Matsu, I think, are wonderful meditation zazen instructions, actually, particularly the tile polishing story. I think of when you're sitting, you can contemplate, now that I'm sitting here, is it that I'm actually trying to make a Buddha here? Do I have some feeling like I'm doing this meditation in order to get more concentrated, more aware, let go more, relax more, anything like that we're doing like that, versus I'm sitting here and actually this sitting here is just sitting here. It's not going anywhere, and there's no future. There's just wholeheartedly sitting in the present, not trying to do anything. And that's one way to open to this mind being Buddha.